it's Diane. Great to be back with you for a Tuesday edition of On My Mind. Novelist Barbara Kingsolver has long combined the personal and the political in her writing. Her books weave the intimate stories of her characters' lives into a backdrop of social commentary. Kingsolver's latest work, Unsheltered, is no different. In it, she asks the question, what does it feel like to live through the end of the world as you know it, when everything you believe to be true is upended? Set in both the 19th and 21st centuries, her characters attempt to find a sense of safety as climate change, economic insecurity, and a rising authoritarian political force loom. I had the pleasure of speaking with Barbara Kingsolver last week at a live event hosted by the Washington, D.C. bookstore Politics and Prose. Hello, everybody. Barbara said to me, I don't know how many of you can see her boots, but she said that she came prepared to hike. I came prepared to sit. So
I'm on a long book tour. She gets to go home after this. I don't.
Two very different agendas. You know, you were thinking about the end of the world and what it would look like when you finished your last book, and now you've sort of moved right on into what could be the end of the world right now.
I'm just a disaster kind of gal. That's sort of my trademark. You know, I never went to all those writing conferences where they tell you what the market wants. I just figured I should write what I know, which is that the world has so much in it that I love and so much loss. And that dialectic of how we hold on to what we love while we're losing so much does turn up again and again, I guess, in my books. But you're right. As soon as I finished a novel about climate change, I looked around and I thought, well, it's not just that the sea level is rising. In so many other ways, so many kinds of familiar shelter, cultural, economic, social contracts are failing us. And this was in 2014, you know, but little did I know.
And of course, you lead me into the very next point, which is that almost every single creature in your novel is in some way unsheltered. Talk about the characters 100 years apart.
Okay. Well, given that I wanted to write about the end of the world as we know it, of course, what a novelist really can do is write about people and the human animal, the human psyche, and our behavior and what we do. And I was watching these different responses people have when we feel insecure, when we feel threatened, when we feel there's not enough to go around. Do we form communities and embrace and help each other, or do we get grabby? And do we say, me first, mine only? Do we look around for the biggest bully to protect what we have? You know, yes, sometimes we do. So I thought it would be interesting to write about this. I think of it as sort of in intellectual terms as paradigm shift. How do we behave when all of the rules we've been following to be good citizens of the world suddenly don't seem to work anymore? Basic things like there will be a job at the end of the college degree.
Tenure.
Right. There will be tenure at the end of the track. There will be a pension at the end of the career. There will be good health care. Even things like there will be ice on the poles. There will always be more fish in the sea. All of these things that so many of us grew up just trusting have been pulled out from under our feet. This is a moment of crisis. So how do you write about a crisis when you're living inside it? It's hard to see it accurately unless you can step outside. And I thought an interesting way to step outside, and if an interesting device for a novel, would be choose some other time in history when people felt that all their familiar shelters were failing them. So I chose, there were, you know, I could have, you know, gone back to the fall of the Roman Empire, but that, you know, that's too far. And anyway, you know, I like to set my novels in the United States of America. And when you look at what was happening here, they had it pretty well here. They were doing okay here at the fall of the Roman Empire. Come to think of it. Anyway, I digress.
Why don't you tell us first about Willa? Because
okay, so
she is someone we really can hang on to and identify with in her confusion, her sadness, her empathy, her understanding.
And her sense of being unsheltered.
Absolutely.
Yes. Okay, so, as Diane suggested, this novel is set in two different time periods. There are two sets of characters. One is the present, and one is not the Roman Empire. We'll get to what it was. And I thought I would create these two sets of characters in two different times and put them in one house, and then of course have the house falling down on their heads, because that's what I like to do. So Willa is the central, the protagonist of the modern story, the contemporary story. She's tried to play by the rules, you know. She was probably a Girl Scout. She got the degree. She supported her husband. She had through his degree. They followed his tenure track. She's worked as a journalist. She did her job well. She had a secure position as an editor in a magazine, and then the magazine folded. So here she is at mid-50s with no career, because mid-50s journalist is sort of like picnic lightning. It's not a happy place to be right in the modern world. And let me tell you, I've had so many interviews. You know, you do a lot of interviews for a book, and so many begin with, "I loved this book. I'm a journalist. I'm a female journalist in my 50s, and my magazine just folded." Okay, I got this one. So she's also trying to hold her family together. She has two kids in their 20s who have, one of them is the golden boy. He went to Stanford. He went to Harvard Business. He should be really employable, but he has enormous debts.
And
other problems.
Other problems. Show up early
right
on
away
in the book.
Yeah, right. As you do, you know, when you buy an ebook now, you get 30 pages to decide. The pressure is on.
Yeah.
You know,
you bet.
I am so conscious of that. So much has to happen in the first 30 pages.
So
yes, we have a death. We have death and disaster. But go ahead.
Willa's husband,
Jano.
Jano, beautiful Greek name with a
beautiful man.
A rather negative father, Nick, who is
Jano's
dying.
Father. So this is the household. Willa lives with her husband, who, after chasing tenure and finally getting tenure, his college folded.
This at the same happens. Time.
This all
I mean,
happens.
Really?
Nick, the father-in-law, who's just a grump, and a sort of a walking Titanic of pre-existing conditions. I think she describes him to the, you know, triage nurse, and also he has this effluent of obscenity just rolling off
totally.
Of him. And
totally.
So he's living
worst language you've ever heard.
Yeah, this will not be adopted into the AP English high school English. My husband pointed this out to me in the first draft. He said, you lost that one. There are some really bad words in there. But sorry. Maybe we could make the expurgated edition or something for you.
We don't need to. Perfect.
Anyhow,
to character.
So there's Nick, who's just a mess. There's Jano, who has had to take this adjunct position, if any of you know what that means. It means it doesn't pay very much. At this point in his career, he's had to take this position very much beneath him. She's got the one son who's got a lot of debts, and she's got this daughter, Tig, who is just a maverick. She just is the, you know, as my mother used to say about me, if you threw her in the water, she would float upstream. That's that's Tig. She's just oppositional. She dropped out of college to go occupy Wall Street. And so now she, because of various circumstances, is also living with them. They've inherited this old brick house in Vineland, New Jersey. And here they are. And it's really incumbent on Willa to try to hold this family together. So that's where we begin. With the contractor saying, she's called the contractor because she thinks she might have some leakage problems, and the first words are, the best thing to do with this house is tear it down. So there we are.
Now, take us back in the novel where we meet another person who is struggling as a teacher, but this is in the era where Darwin is making an appearance and creating so much controversy and negativity that this is the predecessor to the Scopes trial.
Right. So for my previous historical moment of crisis, I chose around 1870. The country had just literally broken in two, had a war. The war was ended by treaty, but not in people's hearts. It was fully as polarized as it is now, interestingly, along very similar cultural and geographic lines. And I'm going to tell you, because I live in southwestern Virginia, and I know the territory, the cultural territory. The slavery question absolutely is settled, but the divides of that war went well beyond that. It was urban versus rural. It was agrarian versus industrial. It was sort of who owns the culture, you know, who gets to decide what it means to be an American. Those divides are still with us. And so I thought it would be interesting to look at an earlier time when this country was so fractured, nobody could figure out how to put these two halves of the country back together. And into that mess walks Charles Darwin. Well, he didn't walk. He sent books, two of them. He published two books. Bless his heart, Darwin was just such a sweet guy. He really was a gentle, sweet, religious man with 11 darling children. And he was a thoughtful man, and he spent 33 years carefully observing the world. And he came to the conclusion, after 33 years, that the laws of nature apply universally. That's all he was saying, that the same laws of nature that apply to a squirrel or a pine tree or a turtle also apply to humans, that we are of this world rather than having been put here to be in charge and to rule it. We're all kind of being ruled by the laws of natural selection and, you know, physiology and geology and physics. It doesn't seem like a big deal, right? It was such a big deal. Thank goodness there was no internet. He got trolled. He was so reviled. He was so hated. It completely surprised him. He was sort of like, well, you know, I've written this out really carefully in these two really long books. And he even kind of left out humans in the first book altogether. He didn't even want to go there. But he just thought, they'll get this, right? He was so hated, and it was so disorienting to people. He got hate mail from Emily Dickinson. That's how bad it was. Poor guy. So I thought, that's a moment. You know, people felt so disoriented in their universe that it must have felt much as it feels now, that all the rules that we've all believed in are just falling away from us. And so I created this set of characters in that time, living also in the same place, in the same house. Also,
The falling down house.
It was already falling down then, yeah. So I used some real historical characters, and I invented some characters as well. But I like to do that. I like to mix it up. But and I'll get to, probably she'll ask me, you know, how you got to Vineland anyway. But Thatcher Greenwood is a young, you know, sort of 30-ish man who has he's gotten an education. He came from a difficult background, but he went to Boston during the war, and he got educated as a scientist. He married this hot babe, this 20-year-old Rosie. He just
hangs her nose in the air.
But she's, you know, he just can't believe this gorgeous, you know, young lady fell for him. So she has some baggage, much like Willa. She has this mother-in-law who is described as a corseted bulwark in a florid, mutton-chopped gown. And she also has her nose in the air. And they're very acquisitional. They want, you know, material things. They want material success. And then there's this kid, sister, Polly, who's 12. And Polly, likewise, if you threw her in the river, up she'd go. She's also, she's a pistol. So Thatcher is trying to hold it all together. He's gotten this gig. He's so thrilled. He's gotten hired in the Vineland High School to teach high school science. It was there were only 12 high schools in the country at that time. So it was a very big deal. There weren't very many students either, because it was mostly a working class town. And so most kids or young humans, by the time they got to age 14, really needed to be at work. So only a few of the scions of this town got to go to high school. But he's teaching high school. He's just read these two books by Darwin. He's on fire. He's so excited. He has a unifying theory. He feels like he can really teach these kids how to understand the world in a new way that's going to help their parents, you know, the whole society kind of move into a new world, cast away some of the old rules and learn new ones. Ixnay on that. That's not going to happen.
Ixnay because
the principal says, we don't do that sort of thing. That's, you know,
God.
Yeah, God.
Is the only.
Yes. He's also, the principal, as it was, you know, as they were in those days, was kind of into, was suspicious, highly suspicious of the scientific method. He didn't really want Thatcher's students to go outside, for example. You know, observation was dangerous.
I mean, literally. He would not let them look at the ants.
They couldn't go across the street and collect acorns. You know, the principal wanted these kids to sit in the classroom and learn, memorize poetry about nature. So, and that was, I mean, and this is not, you know, I was, that's really kind of, that was the approach. Scientific method was a scary thing.
So there is Thatcher dealing with an unforgiving wife who wants more an unforgiving mother-in-law who certainly wants more, and Thatcher, who wants a great deal more understanding for his students of the world. And his house, the same house in which Willa and her family are living 100 years later, is falling down around him. He has no money. He has no tenure. He has a one-year contract.
Right, right.
And if he doesn't do as the principal
says, he's out.
He's lost.
Yeah, and this would not go down well with Rosie.
Isn't this mind of this novelist absolutely fabulous? It's just fabulous. It really is. It really is.
Well, thank you, but we're only 30 pages in.
Yeah.
Well, a little more. But, I mean, I wanted to say, it just sounds, now as we're describing it, I'm thinking, why would you want to read this book? It sounds all terrible, but I wanted to set up, you know, these two sort of experiments with these people who were having to deal with a complete paradigm shift, and then give them ways through it so that you would find something interesting to read about rather than throwing the book across
the
room. In
addition to Charles Darwin, who we don't, of course, meet in person, no. There is Mary Treat, a real-life figure who lives next door to Thatcher. Tell us about Mary Treat, who she was in real life, and her communications with Charles Darwin.
And also perhaps you might want to know, how'd she get in this novel?
Absolutely.
What is she doing there? Well, I for a couple of years, this was a novel in search of a setting. Because I'd set up this device in my mind, these sets of people in these times, looking, you know, in living in one house, and I wanted to find a genuine historical figure that I could bring into this story, who was an advocate, a champion of Darwin's thinking, someone that I could bring into this novel to really represent the new paradigm, who would really have a dog in this fight. You know, somebody who originally I thought about putting Darwin in the novel, but, you know, I already told you that I have to set it in the United States of America. I would have had to put him on a ark or something. No, I wanted it to be historically accurate and interesting, and so I read a whole lot about American scientists of the 1870s who were corresponding with Darwin and kind of trying to promote his ideas on this side of the Atlantic. And you know, there were not very many. There was Asa Gray at Harvard in Boston, who was very well known, and some of his friends and acolytes and colleagues, and I was reading about them and kind of auditioning for them for the role of appearing in this novel. None of them quite did it, and then I just ran across a name I'd never encountered before, Mary Treat, as an important correspondent of Darwin who did experiments with him and for him, kind of testing out his hypotheses and writing to him. I'd never heard of her before. Went looking. No one's ever written a biography of her. She's just never really made it into the record because she's female. She was a prolific writer. She wrote many books and many scientific articles, and also she wrote for the popular press about science and nature. She was a naturalist, botanist, entomologist, and really self-taught, because in those days women weren't allowed to go to college. She went to finishing school, you know, where you learn how to curtsy. That's what she got to do. But she was just one of those women who just hiked up her long dress, you know, tucked it into her waistband, and went tromping in the woods looking at insects and just learning about nature, much as Darwin did. And she left this large body of work in print and nothing about herself. So I thought, and the only personal thing I could find out about her was that she had moved to Vineland, New Jersey, and had lived there for about 20 years when she was most active as a scientist. So here is
a conversation between Mary Treat and Thatcher Greene.
Okay, so she's living next door to Thatcher, and he comes looking for the dogs. They've run away or something.
And he first spots her
lying face down in the grass. The little Rosie is looking out the window saying, "She's lying on the grass. She's looking at ants," you know, and so breathless intrigue. So he has to wander over there one day, knocks on the door, and then they get into a conversation and pretty soon discovers that she agrees with him that he should be teaching natural selection and the ideas of Charles Darwin in the high school. She's got his back, even though, you know, she really can't help him with the principal, but she says, yeah, you got to do this. Thatcher's been kind of lonely, you gather, you know, this is not a marriage of the mind that he's in. And so they just fall into conversation. They become friends very quickly, and they discover they have this passion in common of observing the natural world. And, you know, he's just said, you know, he's probably going to lose his job if he's honest in his work. She can't deny that that's probably true. He says to her, and I will warn you that in the 19th century, people spoke a little differently, just so you know. We're beyond 30 pages in. You've bought the book. Sorry. You're with me here. "You and I are not like other people," he ventured. "We perceive infinite nature as a fascination, not a threat to our sovereignty. But if that sense of unity in all life is not already lodged in a person's psyche, I'm not certain it can ever be taught." And Mary says, "You are a teacher of natural sciences, are you not?" "I am. Also an employee and head of a family. As it happens, a family in dire need of costly home repair. I have inherited a flawed house and find myself pledged to uphold it. If I should lose my home and vocation..." He found it difficult to go on. Since that awful moment with Rose, the day he told her, he had resisted believing a truth he now saw plainly. Mrs. Treat waited for him to say it. "If I lose my position here and fail to find means for preserving our home, I'm sorry to say my wife would probably follow. I would lose her also. I can see no happy end for myself in noble crusades." Mrs. Treat looked him directly in the eye. "Mr. Greenwood, those are qualities personal to you. They have no bearing on the truth." Such words, and yet she'd spoken them without a hint of chastisement, only as one scientist to another. Whatever else he might be, she expected him to be rational. "Of course," he said, "you observe the situation correctly." Now she leaned toward him, guileless as a girl in her confidence. "We are given to live in a remarkable time. When the nuisance of old mythologies falls away from us, we may see with new eyes." "Falls away," he said, "or is torn. The old mythologies are a comfort to many." "But we are creatures like any other. Mr. Darwin's truth is inarguable." "And because it is true, we will argue against it as creatures do. Our eyes are not new, nor are our teeth and claws. I'm afraid I foresee a great burrowing back toward our old supremacies, Mrs. Treat. No creature is easily coerced to live without its shelter." "Without shelter," she said, "we stand in daylight." "Without shelter, we feel ourselves likely to die."
Beautiful. So we move into the 20th century, and indeed the 21st, and you see and read in this book a great deal that sounds like present day. You quote, but never name, a candidate for president who says he could stand in the middle of Fifth Avenue and shoot someone and never be arrested.
Any resemblance to persons living or dead is purely coincidental. I want to get those tweets.
So did you decide you wanted to be absolutely explicit in this novel about this particular president? And if so, why?
Well, he just kind of happened, didn't he? It's so interesting because I had found my setting because I found Mary Treat, I found her papers,
right.
And I found, I should also add, well, when I called the Historical Society that had her archives, they said, you got to come and look at this. And so I went to Vineland, New Jersey, and discovered not only a fabulous character in Mary Treat who was a really interesting woman. She had a crazy husband who ran off to New York after a suffragette who was a champion of free love. And all these really interesting people around her, and that in fact the town of Vineland was established really and truly in 1861 as a utopian community. So what could be more perfect as a setting of my novel to create or to let you look at, to invite you into the Victorian notion of utopia, which by the way involved the working class people doing all the work and the philosophers and ladies having this nice lecture series. And everybody thought, everybody top to bottom thought, this is an ideal world. Except some of us are breaking our backs and getting our farms repossessed. But this guy, Charles Landis, who founded this utopia, made a giant main street down the middle of it named Landis Avenue. He had this funny hair, ruddy cheeks, big ego. He founded this town completely, you know, on his, he, like all the truth was invented by him. He established a newspaper himself as editor, wrote every word in it and published it. He owned everything in the town and used his position as mayor to improve all of his own business prospects. Wow. So this was all real. This is a real character. And people just, when the more scared they got, the more they cleaved to him, or at least some of them did. And there's this dichotomy in the town. You know, there's restiveness. There's this alternative newspaper, you know, this editor publishing what gets called artificial news. It was just too good to be true. And so as I'm researching this place and thinking, how interesting would it be to look at how we behave in times of crisis and how we, you know, turn, what kind of leaders do we turn to when we want, you know, America to be what it used to be before these scary ideas came up? Well, as I'm writing, I'm writing in, you know, real time as the primaries are coming on to the horizon, and I was looking at this whole new kind of leadership, if you can call it that, a new style of
capturing the people.
Thank you. And I just started writing and just thought, wonder where this goes. And so Willa is watching. Nick, of course, is, you know, her father, grumpy father-in-law, has his idea of heaven is to have Fox News blasting all the time, you know, at full volume because he's deaf. She can't stand it, you know. And so So their conversations become about the primaries, and she's saying, this guy disqualifies him every time himself every time he opens his mouth. You know, he'll go away, and Nick is saying he's our guy. And so I'm just writing and thinking sort of in I was writing my first draft sort of in that from the summer before the conventions through the conventions, just watching this experiment that I thought I had invented playing itself out. And I was thinking two possibilities by the time this book comes out, because it takes, you know, it was going to take me another year to, you know, finish, you know, just do all the revisions and then another year for it to be published. So 2 years hence, nobody will even remember this nonsense, or else they will. So I guess good for the book, bad for the world. Here we are.
All right, and we have arrived at that point where if you would like to ask a question, we have a question right here at the front.
So there's this moment, you just mentioned Nick, who is sort of everybody's racist grandpa or racist uncle, but there's this moment in the book with him where she's at her most frustrated with him, but he also has this incredible vulnerability, and she glimpses that, and it's really touching moment. It was a good reminder, right, as we're all sort of like locked into our sides, that there's humanity on every side, and I was wondering if there was anyone in particular or multiple particular people in your life that let you sort of seed in that tiny human little moment.
Well, yes, of course there are. And thank you for pointing this out, because after I set up these households of characters who are really at odds with each other in many different ways, and you know,
politically,
of course,
emotionally, every
politically,
way.
In terms of sort of acquisition, materially, they disagree with each other fundamentally in many ways. And of course, this is what we do as novelists. We set up a microcosm as a nation, you know, a family. Everything in a novel stands for something bigger. You knew that. Your English teachers told you that. So in Willa's family, which is, you know, the Fox News NPR family /nation, I had to love everybody because as a novelist, when I'm creating characters, I have to bring them to you from the inside out. In order for them to be convincing, I have to know really what it feels like to be that person. And everybody thinks he or she is right, right? That's the starting point. So I had to get from me to there before I can really successfully and in any sort of rich and convincing way bring you a character. So
did
yes.
that mean you listened to Sean Hannity and watched Fox News?
That research, yes. I mean, in my previous novel, which involved a lot of an evangelical church as kind of the center of flight behavior, I had to go to, you know, Six Flags Over Jesus. I had to do that. I had to risk getting saved again and again. So, am I? You decide. So, yeah, of course. Yes, I have to do. I had to know what Nick was listening to. And I also listened to my neighbors. And none of my neighbors is Nick. But everybody, you know, I live in the reddest part of a blue state. It's all really purple. You know that. But I have many people in my community and my neighborhood who vote differently, and they are kind and good people, and I, you know, and I have relationships with them, and I just, even without, you know, the extra duty of being a novelist doing her research, I try to listen, but I tried especially hard to think, okay, what it is. So much behavior is driven by fear. What are you afraid of? And I kept hearing this thing about, it's my turn and people are cutting ahead of me in line and I get, you know, and I've lost so much, but this is the small thing I have left, especially if I'm nearing the end of my life and I can see that and I'm not going to get there because somebody else was allowed, you know, to like get ahead. You know, I had to really feel that fear and understand it in order to bring you Nick. And even though, you know, Willa doesn't most of the time can't stand him, even as she's pushing his wheelchair around and he's like using all the racist epithets. And, you know, she's in this position where she has to keep him alive, but she would really rather not. But surprisingly, her daughter Tig, with whom she always fights, Tig is the most patient with Papu. She's the one who can like deal with him and change his bandages and give him his insulin and stuff. And so, you know, I started sort of cross-pollinating this family, but I could only do that once I loved everybody in it. That's the novelist's job. And so when people ask, as sometimes they do, which character is you, the answer is you don't get this at all. Not at all. I'm nowhere. I have to put myself away. The rule, there are many rules. Number one of being a fiction writer, the first one is sit your butt in a chair and stay there. But it's so important for me to put myself aside and understand these characters from the inside so that I can bring you there, because this is the business of empathy. That was a very long answer, but I hope it was useful.
Good. One last question.
Yes. So speaking of character development, is there a character or a group of characters that you like the most that you've developed, or are you...
I love them all. They're like my children. I have to love them equally.
There isn't one storyline?
No, I mean, I get so invested in all of it. I have to go and live with these people. I mean, it is like a marriage. You know, you get in there, you got to make it work. Short stories, that's like dating, you know? Try it out. Done. But I have to invest myself so deeply in these characters, in these stories, and their lives for a period of years that when it's over, there is a kind of postpartum depression. I miss them. I'm sad. My family is happy to have me back. But they do become very real to me. And I mean, because I'm spending most of my time with them, you know, I go into my office and I play with my imaginary friends all day. And, they're for me very, you know, I have to develop them fully. I have to know a lot more about them than you do, in order for me to begin to sort of give them to you in a way that is so convincing. Even though I begin with plot, I begin with what they have to do, and then I invent people who will do what I need them to do, and then I work backwards, and I give them damage. You know, I'm like a therapist in reverse.
I have one last paragraph to read, because this is an issue that means a great deal to me, and I would like your thoughts on it. You write toward the end of the book, "The departure no one could talk about was Dixie's," and that's the beloved dog.
Dog, who's at the end of her life.
You say she would not rise again. Every few hours, Willa carried her outside to urinate, and they had a look at the sky. And when food was placed in front of her, she managed to eat a little. Willa knew this wasn't a life. Soon, they would put her down and bury her under the tree, the one where she peed. Willa could see that for most thoughtful creatures, this was a positive choice. My question to you, considering how thoughtfully you have portrayed Dixie's decline, that I wonder how you feel about medical aid in dying for human beings?
Well, it is a little ambiguous, but I did write there that for most thoughtful creatures, this is a positive choice. I give you that to interpret as you will.
Thank you. And thank you so much for being here.
Thank you.
And thank you all. You've been wonderful. And that's all for today. I'd love to hear what's on your mind. Connect with us on Facebook and Twitter. Send us an email, drpodcast@wamu.org, or leave us a voicemail. The number is 202-854-8851, and go to our website, dianereem.org. Our theme music was composed by Cliff Harden, comes to us courtesy of the Capitol Soundtrack Project here at WAMU. The show is produced by Rebecca Kaufman and Allison Brody. And finally, a special thanks to everyone who made this event possible: Andy Gunn, Josephine Yunai, Ben Privett, Cliff Gallagher, Natalie Urivlivker, and the team at Politics and Prose. Thanks for listening. I'm Diane Rehm.